You got reading in classrooms, of course, writing and arithmetic as well. Now, maybe you're fired, too. There was a ruling in a big teacher tenure lawsuit today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, the 10th of June. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. On the theory that all big legal cases start in a local courtroom someplace, we begin today with a Los Angeles County Superior Court judge who has ruled that this state's teacher tenure laws are unconstitutional, that they deprive students of their right to an education, and that they disproportionately affect low-income and minority students. The phrase landmark case is already being thrown around a bit. Jennifer Medina is covering the story for the New York Times here in L.A. Jennifer, good to have you on.
Thanks so much for having me.
The evidence is compelling, the judge wrote. Indeed, it shocks the conscience. What exactly was at issue in this case?
What's at issue here is how teachers are hired and fired. The way teachers are fired is a very long and complex process, making it very difficult to get rid of teachers who principals and school administrators deem ineffective, and makes it difficult when layoffs happen, get rid of any teachers by any factor other than seniority.
How does that play out in practice? These teachers often get shunted off to low-income schools, to poorly performing schools, right? These teachers who aren't performing.
Right. By the nature of low-performing schools, teachers tend to want to get out of there, often want to get out of there, and so those schools tend to have the highest turnover and therefore often get saddled with teachers who are deemed ineffective. So when you have high turnover of teachers and it's seen as a less desirable school, you're much more likely to get teachers who other schools wanted to get rid of. And people refer to it as the dance of the lemons, because it's the poor schools getting stuck with teachers who are seen as the least desirable.
Some of the testimony in this case was interesting. Raj Chetty, a Harvard economist who we've had on the program before, said, in fact, these students who are not getting what the court has ruled is a decent education lose millions of dollars over the course of their lifetime in earnings.
That's right. And the judge really was swayed, seemed to be quite swayed by his study, which was done sort of with the embrace of the Los Angeles district.
The teachers union, not surprisingly, says it has nothing to do with rules on hiring and firing. It is a far more complicated subject than that. There will, of course, be appeals on this whole thing, right?
Absolutely. I think what's surprising here is the strong language that the judge used in his decision throughout, making it very clear that this wasn't some sort of technical, legalistic ruling, but really something he also saw as a civil rights issue for students.
Setting aside the whole, as California goes, so goes the nation thing, will this, do you think, play out in other states?
Absolutely. In part because of who backed it and how they backed it. It was funded by David Welch, who's a Silicon Valley billionaire, and he has said quite clearly that he intends to or could intend to fund similar cases elsewhere. And without a doubt, advocates across the country are going to see this as a huge win and try to push for advocacy in other states, including Education Secretary Arne Duncan, who released a statement applauding the decision earlier today.
Jennifer Medina, she reports for the New York Times. She's based here in Los Angeles. Jennifer, thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
On Wall Street today, traders did put in a full day working, I think, but all three major indices hit the tape just about where they started, so one never knows, does one? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Most of the northern Iraqi city of Mosul is reported to be under the control of extremist militants linked to the Taliban tonight. It's a group called the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has asked Parliament to declare a state of emergency. They will meet on that tomorrow. In the meanwhile, as many as 150,000 people are said to have left Mosul in the past 24 hours. Nahed Abu Zaid is the Baghdad correspondent for the BBC. We got him in London today. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Tell me about this group, which is responsible for today's events in Mosul, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. Who are they? What do they want?
They are described as being the most extremist group inside the Al-Qaeda-affiliated or Al-Qaeda-inspired militants within Syria and Iraq. They are now focusing on gaining more and more territory to establish their power base inside of Iraq, link up with their comrades across the border in Syria, and start to exert serious pressure and serious challenges to the central authorities in both Damascus and Baghdad.
Why have they gone after Mosul? Put that city in the strategic context of Iraq.
Mosul is one of the main cities in Iraq. It's the second city in terms of population and strategic and economic importance as well. As far as ISIS gaining control, that will pose a real challenge in terms of economy because it's a loss to the government. They are sitting now on large reserves of oil. They do also control a number of banks, which they have ransacked and took over all the money, the cash reserve from those banks. So they can easily now finance their war effort.
This does not, of course, speak well of the control of the country that the government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has. Prime Minister Maliki is hoping for a third term out of the recent elections. What do you think?
Well, your guess is as good as mine. And anything is up in the air here. And negotiations are going on as we speak. In the past, it took 10 months before the political parties in Iraq could agree on a federal government. I would not suspect that this will take as long, especially with the pressing need for them to unify their ranks and represent a unified front. But Mr. Maliki seems to be now the most likely candidate. No other candidate has the strength, political as well as the strength amongst the army officers and the high-ranking officers in the army towards other districts.
Does this end well, do you think?
What we are seeing now is probably a part of the beginning of the end of Iraq as we know it as a state. If they are not stopped soon enough, that could probably spark other cessations in other places of the country. Don't forget, a few years back, there has been similar uprising in the south wanting to declare self-autonomy in Basra and the area, and these were crushed severely by Mr. Maliki's government back then. These aspirations have never gone away. After all, Basra sits on the largest reserve of oil in the country, and it is the poorest area in the country. So one could have a clear idea about how the distribution of wealth is taking place at the moment. So there was a lot of grievances around the place, and I wouldn't be surprised if this would have a chain effect on other areas.
The BBC's Nahed Abu Zaid. We got him in London. He is the BBC's Baghdad correspondent. Thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
The price of crude oil in New York actually fell today, down under $105 a barrel, despite the news from Mosul. A reflection, quite possibly, of how limited Iraq's role in world oil markets has been the past decade or more. As OPEC, of which Iraq is a member, meets in Vienna tomorrow to discuss production quotas for the second half of the year, Marketplace's David Weinberg has this primer on Iraqi crude.
In February, oil production in Iraq hit 3.6 million barrels per day, setting a 30-year record.
Most of it is concentrated in the south, 80 to 90% of it in Basra province alone.
Ben Lando is editor-in-chief of the Iraq Oil Report. Since March, when the Iraq-Turkey pipeline was bombed, production has been restricted. Attacks on repair workers have prevented the pipeline from being repaired.
So that's about 300,000 barrels a day that would have been exported, now shut in.
The Kurdish government in the north is trying to get that oil out. It recently shipped 1 million barrels of crude independently by tanker through Turkey.
From what we can tell, there wasn't a buyer ahead of time, and they're essentially looking for, a port.
Chad Mabry is an analyst with MLV & Company. He says those tankers are basically circling the Mediterranean, waiting for a buyer.
And you're seeing some pressure from the Iraqis that are telling potential buyers, you better watch out if you take that on, or we're going to apply some pressure from our end.
Iraq has set very ambitious goals for oil. The country wants to nearly triple its current production to 9 million barrels per day by 2020, a number that IBIS World analyst James Crompton says is way above industry forecasts.
According to the International Energy Administration, they're forecasting by 2020, Iraq could be producing about 6 million barrels per day.
But even those forecasts may be optimistic if the region faces more instability. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Consider for just a moment the potato. Simple, easy, quite tasty if well prepared. Also this week at the center of a big social policy debate in the Congress of the United States, funding for WIC, the food assistance program geared at low-income women, infants, and children, hence WIC, is expected to come to the floor of the House of Representatives. There are, of course, issues galore on which there is disagreement, including the aforementioned SPUD. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark has more.
WIC gives low-income mothers vouchers that can buy certain foods, foods with nutrients they might not otherwise be getting enough of. A panel of scientists puts together the list, and it's evolved. For a while, carrots were one of the only approved vegetables. But a few years ago, the list was overhauled to add all kinds of fresh fruits and veggies, but no potatoes.
Never would I have guessed that the lowly potato would turn out to be it's such a contentious issue.
That's Republican Senator Susan Collins at an Agriculture Committee hearing recently. She's from Maine, home to a lot of potato growers, and she's been leading the fight to get fresh potatoes, just fresh ones, on the WIC list. She passed around a chart showing the nutritional value of potatoes. A few of her colleagues made hot potato jokes, but this is serious for people like Mark Szymanski with the National Potato Council.
As a National Potato Council and the entire potato industry, we're very concerned when our federal government is telling people that they should avoid our vegetable.
No, I love potatoes. There's nothing more delicious than a baked potato.
Marion Nessel is a professor of nutrition at New York University. As much as she loves potatoes, she supports keeping them off the WIC-approved list.
WIC participants were already eating plenty of potatoes.
Especially French fries and potato chips. Eric Rim is a professor of nutrition at Harvard who advises the USDA.
45% of vegetables consumed by women of childbearing age already are potatoes. It's not like we're a potato-deficient society.
The point of WIC money, he says, is to encourage pregnant women and young kids to go beyond the potato. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Naked and Diaz has such a hand in everything now. They fight tooth and nail with each other. It's very competitive.
Add big-time soccer to the mix, and boy, look out. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 2 points today, basically flat, closed at 16,945. The NASDAQ lifted a point, also flat, 4,337. The S&P 500, yeah, flat as well. Let's make it three in a row. The S&P ticked down less than a point, finished at 19.50. Radio Shack short-circuited 10%. Its quarterly loss was bigger than expected. As it happens, I have to go to Radio Shack this afternoon. The electronics store does have a plan. It wants to become the place to get your smartphone or tablet fixed, so they got that going for them. MetLife rose 0.7%. The insurer says it'll buy back as much as $1 billion worth of its shares. Best Buy powered up 2.3%. The retailer announced a 2-cent bump in its quarterly dividend. Facebook clicked up 4.5% today. Urban Outfitters tore off 3.75%. Molson Coors Brewing poured a 5.3% gain, although I don't understand how that is possible. JPMorgan Chase climbed 0.8%. Bond prices, they fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.64%. And you're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit, listener-supported program, and your support in any amount helps us keep on telling the stories behind the business and economic news of the day. So please help us end our budget year strong by giving at marketplace.org by June 30.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, a look at the nation's balance sheet. The Treasury Department is scheduled to release its monthly statement of how much it took in and spent in May. A House Subcommittee on Communications and Technology holds a hearing on media ownership in the 21st century. Maybe Comcast will come up. and providing more opportunities to get voted off TV, American Idol premiered on June 11th, 2002. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. 10 years ago, Coca-Cola saw an opportunity over in the UK. They saw it in water, bottled water. Didn't go so well, though. In fact, Dasani pretty much bombed over there. But bygones and all that, Coke is going to try again this summer with a different brand, Glasso Smart Water. Marketplace's Stephen Beard brings us up to date.
I would like to say that Smart Water is the purest tasting water there is. I love it.
So the brand, endorsed by Jennifer Aniston, is about to surface on this side of the pond. Coca-Cola is taking the plunge back into the British bottled water market, and for good reasons.
It's a growing market, and that's something you can't really say for soft drinks or any drinks category generally in the UK.
Ollie Waring of the Just Drinks website says bottled water sales are growing at 6% a year in Britain, while other categories are stagnating, chiefly due to health concerns.
You look at high sugar content drinks like cola beverages, they're getting a very hard time. Energy drinks, there are health concerns there amongst consumers. So with bottled water, you pretty much know what you're getting.
Well, up to a point.
Now, the pure fresh taste of Dasani.
When Coca-Cola launched its Dasani bottled water brand in Britain 10 years ago, there was a bit of a problem with the contents. Marketing expert Alison Stewart-Allen.
The problem was that they were discovered to be using the Thames water, buying that water, filtering it, putting it in a bottle and charging a wonderful margin.
It's just tap water, screamed the tabloids. This marketing disaster was then compounded by a manufacturing catastrophe.
As a byproduct of the filtering process, you got a chemical in the water, bromate, and this bromate, in fact, at high levels, is a potential toxin.
Coca-Cola pulled 500,000 bottles off the shelves and pulled the brand out of Britain. 10 years on, does the bitter aftertaste of that debacle linger? Would these bottled water drinkers, Dick Pym, Rosie Pierce and Peter Woodman, be prepared to try a bottle of Glasso Smart Water?
I probably would, just for the curiosity factor, yes.
The Dasani disaster wouldn't put you off?
Well, I didn't know about a disaster, to be honest.
I'm a bit anti-Coca-Cola, so I probably wouldn't buy the water if it was branded at Coca-Cola.
What have you got against Coca-Cola?
Well, just because it's a large contributor to obesity.
I'd probably try it. I would think it would probably be fine.
You wouldn't be put off by the Dasani disaster?
No. I'd give them a second chance.
Coca-Cola is steering well clear of tap water this time around. The new product will be distilled from vaporised spring water. Analyst Ollie Waring reckons that it should sell well, in spite of the Dasani fiasco.
There's a lot of water passed under the bridge since then. And this is a company that knows how to handle brands, knows how to market brands. It kind of knows what it's doing.
And what it wants. Coca-Cola has the third largest share of the world's bottled water sales, but only 1% of Britain's. The company is clearly aiming to tap this country's huge potential. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
All right, quick. What's 4.5 feet long, about 9 feet across, and can fly around for 3.5 hours? If you answered the first officially approved commercially operated drone in U.S. airspace, go straight to the head of the class. Over the weekend, BP sent its 13.5-pound unmanned aircraft to go check out its oil field out on Prudhoe Bay and bring back some 3D maps of the thing. Getting the FAA's approval to do that apparently took some wrangling. The FAA has been working on a set of guidelines for commercial drones for years now. They are, however, still months away at best. And that is the source of much frustration for many, many businesses. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has that story.
You know who needs drones? Sunflower farmers.
The sunflower crop is anywhere from 6 to 7 feet tall and has a large canopy of leaves.
That's John Sandbacken, who runs the National Sunflower Association.
It's very difficult to see down below what's going on. So this would be something with the drone that you could fly over. You could get a much better visual of what's really happening.
The Sunflower Association is one of more than 30 organizations that have petitioned the FAA to speed up with new regulations. Who else? Anybody who deals with one of what Mike Toscano calls the four Ds.
The dirty, dangerous, difficult, and dull jobs that human beings are faced with.
Toscano runs the Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems, drones. His group put out a study last year claiming that drones could add $27 million a day to the U.S. economy. He says drones have two specialties. One, delivering stuff.
Whether you're delivering tacos, beer, medicine, food, water, cell phones, or whatever.
Two, checking things out, like those sunflower crops or BP's oil field. He thinks that second area is where we'll see the next round of approved activity, monitoring crops, pipelines, maybe even smokestack emissions. Hollywood's a candidate. Meanwhile, a lot of small timers have started jumping the gun. Florists, real estate photographers, an online pharmacy.
By and large, FAA enforcement has been spotty. And so they've been able in many instances to do so with impunity.
That's Rebecca McPherson, a former FAA attorney. She says the process of making and enforcing regulations may take a long, long time. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
The World Cup, as perhaps you've heard, starts Thursday in Sao Paulo, Brazil. There will be soccer aplenty, or football if you're a purist, over the next month. But a match of different sorts is already well underway. The sales competition between Nike and Adidas, or Adidas if you're a purist. The two companies go at it year after year, but the World Cup is a rare opportunity to market to the world. From Portland, Oregon, Conrad Wilson reports.
The walls of Tersey Soccer Store are lined with shoes. Its display looks like something out of a modern art museum. The lighting just perfect, holding soccer cleats in a sort of suspended animation. One display has a few shoes behind glass and gives off the faint sound of a club beat.
So Nike and Adidas comes here and does this. They do all, they come in and actually put all the displays up. We give them half the store each, and they get to do what they want with it.
Jim Tersey runs the store. Spring and summer are always busy, he says, but this year's a World Cup year, and business is up 30%. Not only that, but Nike and Adidas launched a slew of new jerseys, shoes, and soccer balls, all leading up to the start of the tournament.
Nike and Adidas has such a hand in everything now. They fight tooth and nail with each other. It's very competitive.
Last year, Nike's soccer business brought in nearly $2 billion. Adidas didn't release its figures last year, but expects to sell more than $2.7 billion worth of soccer gear this year. Courtney Brunius is with USC's Sports Business Institute. He says the World Cup is the perfect place for this turf war.
It almost stands alone in terms of the ability for brands and sponsors to get out there and reach such a wide group of potential customers.
But here's the interesting thing. Nike's been in the soccer business for about two decades. Adidas has been at it since 1949. Paul Swinand is an analyst with Morningstar.
They've since maybe even pulled even or only slightly behind Adidas in soccer.
In 2008, Nike purchased Umbro and sold it just a few years later, but not before gutting the company of several multi-million dollar sponsorship deals.
The sponsorships are really key in the global sales dominance.
With this move, Nike was able to put its logo on the jerseys of teams like Manchester City and England's national team. Swinand says it gave Nike a boost to compete.
Adidas is very sensitive to somebody encroaching on their brand heritage. They've pushed very hard to maintain the lead.
But that sales lead for Adidas, if there is one at all, may not be forever. Back in his store, Jim Tersey says for the 18-year-olds and under, Nike dominates his soccer shoe business. He says Nike's holding off on one final shoe that comes out the first day of the tournament, the new Superfly.
We can't show it yet because we're not allowed to, because it's all top secret as they do things.
Do you have them here?
Yes, I do. Do you want to see one? Yeah.
Okay.
Tersey heads into the back room, reaches onto a shelf, and grabs a brightly colored soccer cleat. Nike calls the color Hyper Punch, a mix of blinding pink and hunter orange, with the company's signature swoosh across the top.
How much are these? So these are the new Superflies. How much are those?
$275.
So there you go. Special color. Special, unique design. Nobody else has this. These will go June 12th. All sold out.
But don't worry, Tercey says. In a month, the World Cup will be over. Pretty soon, he says, the buzz will be about whatever Nike and Adidas do next. In Portland, I'm Conrad Wilson for Marketplace.
This final note today, in which we give just a glancing blow to the masterful public relations campaign being waged by Hillary Clinton's publishers for her new book, Hard Choices. Time magazine knows how hard it can be to come up with snappy titles for political memoirs, so they have created a political memoir name generator just to help you out. Mine, when I eventually write it, is going to be called A Charge to Compete, or maybe it won't. We've got a link at our website. It's marketplace.org. Check it out. Also, and I know it is somewhat out of the ordinary for me to revisit a previous final note, but for those of you who said yesterday that yes, indeed, you would wear shorts with a suit, and there were more than a couple of you, it is time to put up or shut up. Tweet us a picture at Marketplace or it didn't happen. All right, we are done. Today, the Dow up 2 points, basically flat. The NASDAQ up a point, also flat. The S&P 500 was the loser, down less than a point, also flat. Nancy Fargali is our senior producer of special projects. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Esch are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin and Shea Huffman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.